Well, hello and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. This is my first podcast after 5 consecutive tours over 2.5 years, while the first 5 of the 9 books that I wrote during lockdown were published. As of a couple of days ago, when I got back from San Francisco, the last of those stops associated with all of those books is done. I do have some appearances coming up, but they're not really book appearances. If you're in Amherst, New York or Buffalo, New York, you can see me June 6th through 9th at the Media Ecology Association. I'm going to be giving the keynote and accepting a Neil Postman Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Media Literacy. I'll also be at Hope Hackers on Planet Earth in Queens on July the 14th, and that's on my way to Chicago. On the 21st of Chicago, I'll be at the American Association of Law Libraries to do a keynote, and on the 20th, I'll be doing a talk inside the loop at a bookstore that is not yet announced. I also have some appearances that are not yet in the calendar, although I can tell you about them. I'll be at DEF CON in Las Vegas in August, and I'll also be at Burning Man, where I will definitely be speaking at Palenque Norte and probably also at Center Camp again, as well as doing a talk with my camp, Liminal Labs, a Q&A. So all of that is coming up. I am home. I am home for a protracted period for the first time in 2.5 years. I'm so glad to be home. It's so great to have retired my suitcase for a while. It's so great to wake up every day in the same place. It's so great to be able to sort of tackle some of my routine. And it's really great to be able to get to this mile-long to-do list I have. Like, there are these beautiful liquor bottles I bought that I think I can cut down into weird little rocks glasses, and my kombucha is exploding in the cupboard and I need to do something about it. And I have a couple of turkey carcasses in the freezer that I need to turn into stock. And I'm gradually, day by day, going through each of the shelves in my office and in my closet and doing one shelf per day, dusting it off, picking through everything, kind of Marie Kondoizing it, getting rid of things. It's very hard to get rid of gifts, but I think that the givers, if they ever knew that after many years of enjoying their gift, you then passed it on, would not be upset, or at least I hope they would be. You know, the good news is that if you're anywhere near my little free library here in Burbank, there are some really good books going out there, books that I quite enjoyed, but probably won't read again and need to clear out to make space. And the thrift shops of Burbank are bulging with cool old t-shirts that I haven't worn in many years and probably won't wear again and, again, need to make space with. And so I'm really feeling quite relieved to be getting through all of this backlogged stuff and helping my kid with stuff. She's just made up her first resume because she's applying for her first part-time job, and we worked on that together yesterday. It's really cool. Anyway, this week I'm going to read to you my latest column from Locust magazine. It's called No One is the Enshittifier of Their Own Story, from the May 2024 edition of Locus magazine. No one was more surprised than I was when the American Dialect Society named enshittification, my dirty little coinage, to describe how everything on the internet is suddenly, simultaneously, getting much worse, to be its word of the year. But though the news was a surprise, it was a very pleasant one. My early writings on enshittification focused on its symptoms, the way platforms decay. The progression of the disease looks like this. First, companies are good to their users. Once users are lured in and have been locked down, companies maltreat those users in order to shift value to business customers, the people who pay the platform's bills. Once those business users are locked in, the platform starts to turn the screws on them too, extracting more and more of the value generated by end users and business customers, until all that remains is the meanest residue, the least amount of value that can keep everyone locked into the platform. These symptoms are all around us now, from the Uber riders who pay more while their drivers make less money, to the YouTube viewers who watch more ads while performers get less money, to the Amazon customers who pay more for goods from sellers who earn less money. Enshittification isn't just a collection of symptoms, though. These symptoms depend on a mechanism, a technical property of digital platforms that enables all these shell games with the value created by end users and business customers. I call that mechanism twiddling, the ability of digital platforms to change prices, rankings, and other key aspects from instant to instant on a per-user basis. A good example of this is found in Uber's labor pricing scam, a practice the sociologist Vina Dubel dubbed algorithmic wage discrimination. Uber drivers who are more selective about which jobs they're willing to take get paid more than their less discriminating colleagues. This is a fully automated process. Uber's labor pricing algorithm makes a continuous stream of judgments about how much a driver should be offered to do a given job based on how often that driver turned down other jobs they've been offered. If these higher payouts lure drivers to become less discriminating, the algorithm starts to titrate their wages down, toggling the price per mile up and down in minute increments based on the previous offer's outcome, like a fisher playing the reel in and out as their prey gradually tires. Gradually, Uber drivers are tricked into giving up the side hustles that let them be so selective about their rides. Then, as they become more and more dependent on the platform, their wages are drained away to the bare subsistence minimum. The wage pricing algorithm is twiddling the payout knob from moment to moment, playing a shell game with inexhaustible superhuman speed. In every shell game, the quickness of the hand deceives the eye. Digital platforms have the fastest hands around. It's not that black-hearted coal bosses and other stock villains of analog capitalism didn't dream of this kind of payroll shenanigans. It's that they couldn't hire enough payroll clerks in green eyeshades to make that dream a reality. Digital twiddling continuously changes prices, wages, and recommendations, making it impossible for business customers and end users to consistently understand the deals they're making in order to get the most out of those deals. The observable progression of enshittification, the fluid, continuous shunting of value from users to business customers to the platform shareholders, rely on the invisible work of this twiddling. Their somatype and genotype, or more accurately, their pathogen and symptom. But understanding the means and the method doesn't explain the moment. Why is everything enshittifying right now? For that, we have to unpack the epidemiology of enshittification. What is the contagion that has enshittified every business all at once? Therein lies the tale. The same people running the same companies are all suddenly behaving very differently. They haven't all suffered a change of heart, a reverse inscrutioning that caused them all to go to bed the kinds of good-natured slobs who made services we loved and wake up cruel misers who claw away all the value we created together. Rather, these people, leaders of tech companies and the managers and product designers they command, have found themselves in an environment where the constraints that kept them honest has melted away. Whereas before, a manager who was tempted to enshittify their offerings had their hands stayed by the fear of some penalty, today those penalties are greatly reduced or eliminated altogether. The first of these constraints was competition, the fear that a customer would leave for a rival platform. Two generations of lax antitrust enforcement took care of this constraint. In every sector, but especially tech, nominal competitors have intermarried, merging and remerging into corporate polycules where everyone is in bed with everyone. Even where companies nominally compete, say the ad tech sector, dominated by Google and Meta, they secretly collude to rig their markets, dividing up their territories like the Pope dividing up the New World. The second constraint is regulation, the fear that a government enforcer will punish a company that cheats its suppliers, workers, or customers. Without competition, regulation is a dead letter. A sector composed of a handful of companies can easily agree on a lobbying strategy, and thanks to the absence of wasteful competition, these conspirators have lots of profits to spend on making that strategy a reality. The third constraint is self-help. The same flexibility that enables enshittifiers to twiddle our value away also allows us to twiddle it back, in theory. For every printer ink price hike, there is a potential market for third-party ink cartridges that take back the margins HP or Epson think they deserve. For every dime made by increasing the intrusiveness of an online ad, there's a dollar to be lost on a customer who is so off-put that they figure out how to turn on ad blocking. This constraint is another casualty of the regulatory capture that follows from market concentration. Regulatory capture doesn't just let large companies ignore the law, it also lets them inflict the law on their users and companies that seek to help them. The explosion of so-called IP laws, anti-circumvention, tortious interference, non-compete, non-disclosure, patent, trademark, and on, allows dominant companies to block and even criminalize these aftermarket correctives to their enshittifying impulses. The fourth and final constraint was labor. Tech bosses motivated their workers by appeals to a sense of mission, telling techies they were part of a great work of bringing forth a digital society that was more connected, faster, and better. This worked great. These workers missed family funerals and slept under their desk to ship code, but failed badly. The problem is that when you appeal to a worker by inspiring a sense of duty and mission, you will have to contend with that sense of duty and mission when you ask them to enshittify the products they poured their lives into. And because tech workers were in such high demand, they could simply refuse to work on projects that made users worse off in order to make shareholders better off. But in an environment of mass tech layoffs and even bigger stock buybacks, tech workers have lost their bargaining power. Today, the answer to "I refuse to worsen this product due to the moral injury that would cause me" is fine. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. That is why everyone is enshittifying right now. The tech bosses who once made good products told themselves that they did so because they were virtuous. But much of that virtue stemmed not from their character, but from the consequences of failing to deliver good products at fair prices under ethical conditions. No one is the villain of their own story, and no one is the enshittifier of their story either. Since the days of the first tech platforms, tech bosses have always tried to twiddle the knobs to shift value away from platform users to their investors. But in the main, the constraints of competition, regulation, self-help, and workers stop them from turning that knob too far or too frequently. From the boss's perspective, nothing has changed about their behavior. 10 years ago, they twiddle the knob as far as it would go every chance they get. Today, they do the same. The difference is that today, those knobs turn much more freely. All right, that's it. I think I'm in town next Sunday. I can't think of where I'd be. I think I get to stay put for a while. And if that's the case, yes, next Sunday, I will be in town. And so I will be recording another podcast for you. Oh, and look at that. Right afterwards, my friend Ted is arriving from Toronto, and we're going to go see Stop Making Sense at the Pantages Theatre, where Talking Heads, all of the band members, will be appearing to talk about the production of the movie. Ted is a pal of mine from high school, maybe the only bigger Talking Heads fan than me that I know. And we did this before when Talking Heads played at the Toronto International Film Festival, and Ted came despite having been very badly injured when a car hit him just a couple of days earlier. He showed up in a wheelchair with various parts of his body immobilized and bandaged and saw the show. And there's even a short documentary about him that I included in a link recently in my Pluralistic newsletter. Anyway, that's going to be so much fun. So I expect I'll be very excited about that when I speak to you next week. And boy, I just realized I'm only like 10 days out from seeing Stop Making Sense and meeting Talking Heads again at the Pantages. What a treat that's going to be. Anyway, I'll talk to you next week. You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, This song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.